Coming up, an American Muslim leader on demands for the UN to restrict free speech. Also, a Fred DeSam Lazaro report on unarmed paid civilian peacekeepers. They seem to be successful, but...
We have to remain humble, and this is not a tool that fits every situation and that will rid the world of war.
Plus, how Jews experience the joyous holiday of Sukkot, all next week.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The Jane Henson Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernathy. It's good to have you with us. As protests against an anti-Islam video continued in many parts of the world, debates over tolerance, free speech, and religiously motivated violence were front and center at the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. In a strong speech, President Obama again condemned the video as an insult to Muslims and to all Americans. But he said America rejects attempts to restrict even speech that insults religion.
We do so because, given the power of faith in our lives and the passion that religious differences can inflame, the strongest weapon against hateful speech is not repression. It is more speech. The voices of tolerance that rally against bigotry and blasphemy and lift up the values of understanding and mutual respect.
The president also called on world leaders to speak out forcefully against extremism.
That brand of politics, one that pits East against West and South against North, Muslims against Christians and Hindu and Jews, can't deliver on the promise of freedom.
But many Arab and Muslim leaders renewed their calls for a UN resolution that would ban defamation of religion. Egypt's new president, Mohamed Morsi, said his country respects freedom of expression, but, he added, not the freedom of expression that deepens ignorance and disregards others. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad once again generated controversy in a speech that accused what he called uncivilized Zionists of threatening war against his country. Protesters outside the UN denounced Ahmadinejad's continued anti-Semitic language. Many Jews were particularly upset that his speech fell on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest day on their calendar. Meanwhile, several world leaders urged the UN to do more to end the conflict in Syria. Many warned of a looming crisis facing the nearly 300,000 Syrian refugees who have fled to neighboring countries. UN humanitarian officials called for more international aid and said if the fighting doesn't end, the number of refugees could rise to 700,000 by the end of this year. In addition to emergency aid, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said a top priority for the international community should be promoting sustainable development that will provide long-term help for poor countries. Governor Mitt Romney sounded similar themes at former President Bill Clinton's global initiative. Romney urged a reexamination of temporary foreign aid.
It can employ some people for a time, but it can't sustain an economy, not for the long term. It can't pull the whole cart, if you will, because at some point the money runs out. But an assistance program that helps unleash free enterprise can create enduring prosperity.
The calls at the UN for outlawing offensive speech produced strong defenses of such speech, not only by President Obama, but also from leaders in the American Muslim community. I want to explore that with Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and Haris Tareen, director of the Washington Office of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Haris, How are you trying to persuade, how are American Muslims trying to persuade other Muslims around the world that putting any kind of limit on free speech is dangerous?
Well, I think the first way we're trying to convince fellow Muslims of this is the fact that the idea of free speech is a foundational part of the Quran itself. We don't only believe that in terms of Americans and our belief in the Constitution, but the Quran challenges folks to engage in dialogue and in discourse. It challenges people of the same faith and various different faiths as well. So it's foundational to the text of Islam, we believe. The Quran actually records insults to the Prophet Muhammad himself. And challenges people to engage in that discourse. So I think it's foundational not only to the Constitution, but to our sacred texts as well.
Are you getting anywhere with that argument?
I think we are. We are. We've put out several videos in various languages, in Dari, in Pashto, Arabic, Somali, and they've gotten close to 1 million views by folks in the Muslim world. And we've gotten a very positive response, especially from young people who went out onto the streets of Cairo, of Tunis, of Libya, to ask for their right for free speech to begin with.
I've been struck also, I've been following this debate for a while, and it's not just Muslim-majority countries that are pushing for these restrictions on defamation against religion, although they've been at the forefront of it, but it's an idea that also has traction in some African and Latin American countries where people have this idea that religion is somehow different and that you shouldn't insult religion. And in fact, you know, even in Western Europe, there's some, I mean, already it's against the law to deny the Holocaust in many European countries. So our notion of free speech, especially when it comes to religion, is not shared around the world.
But is it changing?
I think it is changing. I think that as the world becomes smaller, we live in a globalized world, and people are realizing, as President Obama said in his UN speech, that someone with a phone camera can really cause a stir around the world, and so that we've got to be able to adjust. We've got to be able to have a discourse and dialogue when it comes to difficult issues like this, rather than take the streets and commit acts of violence.
I found it interesting. American Muslims seem to be speaking to two audiences, in effect, because on one hand, you're speaking to Muslims around the world, but on the other hand, you're also speaking to American societies and trying to say not all Muslims are like the people who are in the streets doing violence. I mean, has that been a challenge for you all?
It is a difficult balancing act, but I think people realize that the majority of people who are out on the streets, there were a very small number, and amongst those small number, the ones who committed acts of violence were even smaller. As we were saying earlier, in Libya, people came out in the thousands in support of the ambassador, in support of our country.
But there's also some politics in here, isn't there? I mean, hardliners in some of these countries, are they not, are encouraging some of the violence in order to put pressure on these new fragile governments
to
become hardline themselves?
Absolutely, absolutely. These countries are nascent democracies and hopefully democracies. There's a vacuum of power and a vacuum of authority in many of these societies. So extremists are taking advantage of this vacuum in power and authority. And unfortunately, they don't want to see a free, democratic Libya or Egypt or Tunisia or Pakistan. They want to see an extremist vision for their societies. So they're trying to take advantage of this vacuum of power. And what we have to do is stand on the side of the majority to ensure that we marginalize the extremists in those societies and also the extremists who put the film together and promoted the film as well.
I noticed that your organization, in a statement, really did call on the Muslim community to also examine the role of extremism within the Muslim community. And certainly that's a theme that President Obama talked about this week as well in the UN speech, where he was a little more forthright than he has been in the past in calling on nations to deal and leaders of nations to deal with extremism in their midst.
Thanks to Kim Lawton and to Haris Tareen.
Thank you
for being with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
In the U.S., there's also an ongoing debate over the limits of free speech, highlighted by two recent events. A federal judge in New Orleans temporarily blocked a city ordinance that outlaws preaching on Bourbon Street after dark. The law bars people from disseminating social, religious, or political messages on the street between sunset and sunrise. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit on behalf of a local preacher after members of her ministry were arrested. And in New York City, a prominent Egyptian-American blogger was arrested after painting over a controversial subway ad that equates jihad with savagery. The hotly debated ad, now in several subway stations, urges people to defeat jihad and support Israel against, quote, the savage. Several Muslim and interfaith groups have protested the ads. The sponsors insist they are protected by the First Amendment. In other news, there was more scholarly debate this week over the so-called Gospel of Jesus' Wife, an ancient scrap of papyrus a Harvard professor says might be evidence some early Christians believed Jesus was married. The Vatican this week called the item a fake and a clumsy forgery. A special Church of England panel held 3 days of closed-door meetings to select the next Archbishop of Canterbury, spiritual leader of the 78-million-member worldwide Anglican Communion. The new archbishop will succeed Rowan Williams, who has been in the position since 2002 and is retiring. The nominating panel submits the name of its preferred successor, along with an alternate, to British Prime Minister David Cameron. The Prime Minister then gives his selection to Queen Elizabeth for final approval. In Saudi Arabia, 1,000 Nigerian Muslim women were detained at the airport after they arrived in the country unaccompanied by men. The women were on their way to Mecca to perform the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage, which will take place next month. Saudi Arabia requires female pilgrims to travel with a male escort and is sending the women back to Nigeria. The U.S. Catholic bishops this week pledged unconditional support for the Catholic Church in Nigeria after a cathedral was bombed there last weekend. The attack is the latest in a long line of church bombings by the radical Islamist group Boko Haram. At least 4 people were killed and nearly 50 wounded. More than 100 have died in similar attacks in the past year. The Catholic bishops say they will urge the State Department to do more to stop the violence. Around the world, the most prominent peacekeepers are 120,000 blue-helmeted UN soldiers drawn from the armies of dozens of nations. At the same time, in other conflict zones and fragile ceasefires, another approach is being tested. It's the use of civilians, paid, unarmed, and apparently effective. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from the Philippine island of Mindanao.
Its lush, verdant fields are a food basket for the Philippines, but Mindanao is also a tense, highly militarized place. Tens of thousands of people across this Indiana-sized island have been forced to flee their homes for squalid camps. On paper, there's a ceasefire in the long-running insurgency in this most Muslim region of the Philippines, a predominantly Christian nation.
Died on the spot, the girl.
However, the threat of sporadic fighting is never far away. 2 days before we got here, this 6-year-old child was caught in a crossfire. Taking notes on incidents and conditions in the camps are unarmed observers, foreign and local, with a group called Nonviolent Peace Force.
How many families are still in Luanan?
There are still 104 families staying here. We go to our farms during the day, but come back here at night.
The presence of these monitors and their constant interaction deep inside communities is credited with helping prevent flare-ups, lower the number of skirmishes, and preserve the precarious ceasefire. They are praised both by the Philippine Army, which patrols some areas of the island, and the main rebel group that covers the rest, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. The front's roots lie in a movement by ethnic Moros who are Muslim. It initially sought independence, but over the years has moderated the demand to greater autonomy from Manila.
Do you consider yourself Filipino?
No.
No. By citizens, by citizenship, yes. By nationality, no. I am a Moro. By nationality.
Mindanao has known conflict for centuries, beginning with resistance to the Spanish colonists, and more recently, resistance to the incorporation of this island into the Philippine Republic. That happened in 1946, and since then, migrants from other islands have come here, and today, those mostly Christian settlers outnumber the mostly Muslim original islanders by better than 2-1. Journalist Glenda Gloria, who wrote a book about the Mindanao conflict, says it's as much about economic inequality as religion. She says much of today's problems trace back to the dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who ruled from 1965 to 1986.
The Marcos government instituted a lot of government policies that oppressed the minority Muslims, that took them away from the economic and political pie. And after that, the abusive military really violated human rights just to run after these rebels who wanted to separate from the republic at that point.
That sowed the seeds for radicalization among some rebel fighters, she says. By the 1990s, a regional al-Qaeda affiliate called Abu Sayyaf began to thrive.
Is Abu Sayyaf growing?
As far as we're concerned, it's not growing. They are still confined. That's the one of the successes of our government security forces in that portion of Mindanao.
Philippine officials say they've largely defeated Abu Sayyaf as a military threat, helped by U.S. advisors who remain in the region. And recent governments have made progress toward a peace treaty, offering greater autonomy and control over the island's resources to the Moro people. And officially, there's a ceasefire. However, between splinter rebel factions and clashes among rival warlords, the ground reality is still unsettled.
The military has set up a camp. Does that still not give you enough confidence to be staying there at night?
Back at the displaced persons camp, community leader Abdul Manan Ali said armed groups continue to pose a threat.
I think families are still insecure about the situation.
A few minutes later, the monitors were relaying the citizens' concerns to the Philippine military, which is in charge of security in this area.
Some of the members of communities are suggesting to bring my platoons near. The problem is, again, bringing the military inside the community, it might cause some another problem. So we have to study this some more.
Among the many shortages, trust is a major one. And that's a void that both sides agree the foreign civilians are filling.
Only an armed civilian protection monitors would be effective, because our people have been traumatized. If they only see government and MILF working in civilian protection, there is no impartiality.
Since they are foreigners, the perception could be they are neutral compared to local organizations that are involved in the peace process.
Regardless of their faith.
Regardless of their faith. I think the Nonviolent Peace Force is a mixture of Hindus, Christians, and Muslims.
The group is now based in Belgium but was started in Minneapolis. Co-founder Mel Duncan, who was in Mindanao during our visit, says his earliest inkling that the concept might work came in the 80s. He was living in Nicaragua, where he'd gone as a peace activist during the civil war there.
What we found over a seven-year period was none of those villages were ever attacked when there was an international presence. This was at a period of a war where 50,000 people were being killed.
Refining and putting the idea into practice took years of studying similar attempts, he says, including an ill-fated one during Bosnia's civil war.
In the mid-90s, there was an effort, Mirsada, in Sarajevo, where people primarily from Europe had been recruited, many of them not trained, and they came into a situation where they, in fact, drew artillery into the areas where they were trying to protect, and they made a lot of problems in terms of having to be taken out.
In contrast, monitors hired by Nonviolent Peace Force are full-time and salaried, about $1,500 per month. They come to stay, hire local staffers, and work with local civic groups. Raghu Menon, trained as a lawyer in India, says it makes a big difference.
As you would see, there are no fences, no guards outside our office, in spite of the fact that Picket, where we are based, is considered to be a dangerous place by most Filipinos. But because we are living in a community which supports our work, which understands our work, I think we draw a lot of our security from that.
Long before they deploy, the group spends months studying the conflict, meeting the key players, and forging partnerships with citizen groups.
We have to engage with local partners who can understand things in ways that internationals will never be able. War is complicated, and so is peace. And we're always learning at this, and that's... We have to remain humble, and this is not a tool that fits every situation and that will rid the world of war.
The group's first deployment was in Sri Lanka during its civil war, where Duncan says it was particularly effective in rescuing child soldiers. Besides Mindanao, monitors now serve in South Sudan and Georgia, and he hopes they'll serve in more conflict zones soon.
We certainly could be... provide effective protection in Myanmar, in Kyrgyzstan, perhaps in Syria as the conflict unfolds.
Nonviolent Peace Force's annual budget of $7.5 million comes from the UN and governments from several developed nations, though not the U.S. Duncan says not yet. And among its merits could be the price tag. Duncan says an unarmed civilian costs about half what the UN pays to deploy a typical armed, blue-helmeted soldier. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro on Mindanao Island in the Philippines.
Finally, this coming week, following the solemnity of the high holidays, comes the joyous Jewish holiday of Sukkot. Families build temporary shelters, or sukkahs, in which they gather for meals and, for some, where they sleep as well. Our guide to Sukkot is Rabbi James Michaels of the Hebrew Home of Greater Washington, D.C.
The book of Leviticus tells us that we should remember that God allowed us to live in temporary shelters, the sukkah, when we lived in the desert for 40 years. We lived in booths, knowing that we were going to move from place to place. Not necessarily every day, but certainly from one year to the next, we lived in different areas. The sukkah that we build every year is to remind us of that experience. The basic requirement is that the roof must be artificial and have more shade than light, but must be open to the elements. The walls can be made out of anything. As you can see in the background, mine are made of canvas, and these are very popular. There's all sorts of decorations. Some plastic fruit. Some people will put up real fruit, vegetables up there. People will put even Christmas lights in it. When my wife was growing up, she would take all the holiday cards that they received for the new year, and they would cut out the pictures and hang them up on their sukkah. I've heard of people sleeping in the sukkah. It's not really required, but there are some people who do it. The important thing is the eating and the sharing of meals, because that is the basic activity that we do in our home. One of the things that we do on Sukkot is take what we call the four species, the Arba Minim, which is a palm branch, sprigs of willow, sprigs of myrtle, and a citron, which looks like a large lemon.
Praised are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe.
We hold all four of those and we wave them. And we smell them and we hear them.
North,
so that experience south, is something that really gives us a very nice feeling of being alive, of being in touch with our senses. 5 days ago, on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, we denied ourselves any sensory experiences. Everything was thinking, sitting, and praying. Sukkot is just the opposite. It's an indulging of the senses. Every one of our senses is indulged when we sit in the sukkah and enjoy the atmosphere, the food, hear the sounds of the city, hear the sounds of the countryside if we're living out in a rural area. People think that religion is only one aspect of life. No, it involves everything. There's just as much for physical and sensory experiences as there is for contemplation and meditation.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on smartphones. There's always much more on our website as well. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Vietnamese Catholic drummers performing at this year's Marian Days Festival in Carthage, Missouri.